Excuse me, the recordings have now started.
Okay, so now that we've decided that some people like the term hardcore and others don't. Okay, so the today's agenda, the roll call, please.
Yes, I'll do the roll call for you, Michele. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. On today's call, we have Michele Nalon, James Bledel, Barbara Steele, Paul Diaz, Kevin Erdman, Mike O'Connor, Michael Collins, Barry Cobb, Chris Chaplow, Anil George. We also have on Adobe Connect Rudy Van Snick, who's not able to join on the call. From staff, we have Marika Konings and Olof Nordling. Apologies, Boudouin Chombe. And if I could just remind everyone, please to state their names when they talk for transcript purposes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Michele again here. Okay, we were looking at IRTP definitions and concepts. And I believe Marika put a document up on Adobe Connect, which is based on some of the to-ing and fro-ing we've had on the list. Have you all had a chance to look at the document on Adobe Connect?
Chris, I'm still just getting into it.
Mikey has his hand up.
Oh, I'm just ready to... We had a flurry of email right at the very end, our typical pattern. And I think Chris tossed a couple of more terms in that we might want to consider. And I'm just jumping in on that whenever you feel like doing that.
Okay, so we'll... Okay, then. So anybody, has anybody got any comments on the document that Marika put up based on Tim's definitions?
This is Marika. Just to note, I think Tim's email was based on what James initially proposed with already, I think, some changes to the title account holder.
Okay.
And then at the end, you'll see added what Chris proposed in his email. So you know, the idea of this document is just to have everything in one place so people can scroll through it and, as we discuss, look at the different issues on the table.
Okay. Mikey, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, this is Mikey. I liked Chris's terms, if we can determine whether they're relevant to inter-registrar domain transfers as opposed to some of the other PDPs that are running right now. And the way that I kind of, in torturous logic, got them to be relevant has actually been captured in the paragraph right before those two. In that, I think that when the actual transfer and the unwinding of the transfer takes place, James and Barbara are right that the reseller service provider really doesn't enter into that. But where they may enter in is in causing the need for that. And to that extent, I found those useful because... it's true that there are times when our current list of definitions doesn't cover all the players in a scenario. And so that's the reason that I would lobby for having those in there. I'm not sure that I've read the definitions carefully enough to whether they won, but at least the idea of those two additional players acknowledged in the conversation seems like a good idea to me.
Okay, Paul Diaz?
Yeah, thanks, Michele. Mikey and James and everybody, I really appreciate the conversation on the list. It's unfortunate that it came just before the call because maybe not everybody's been there. One thing that struck me, and it's just sort of a follow-on on what you've just said, Mikey, is that I think we need to be very careful and remember in these alternative or these other entities that we're discussing that we do keep in mind, you know, where so back to James' point, you know, that the sort of ends with the registrant, the importance of there needs to be some contract that we can point to. You know, the resolution process that we have, if there's, you know, question, debate, as Barbara's noted, you know, they look to what can we point to, what's there. I think we were spinning out a lot of very interesting and often very frustrating scenarios that exist in the real world, but all too often those players that are involved don't have any, for lack of a better term, legal ground to stand on. And I think for our group and our discussions, and when we define the entities that are involved, that we, you know, keep in mind what is in the, what has been envisioned in the ICANN processes already, what is defined by contract, and then if there are others that are outside of that that really need to be brought in, fine, they can be clearly highlighted. But we need to guard against kind of perhaps trying to capture everybody that might possibly be involved in something, because ultimately they won't have the ground to stand on for the purpose of this working group, which is transfers.
Okay, James?
I think that Paul captured just about all of my sentiments there, which was the idea that we cannot continue to follow all of the relationships indefinitely. We have, and I'm sure that the same goes for other registrars, we have teams of folks that work on these types of issues daily and understand all of the players, but ultimately it comes down to the reach of the reach of the ICANN policy and the reach of the registration agreement. And then beyond that, it starts to become not only confusing but also somewhat irrelevant. So I just wanted to kind of add what Paul says, is that to keep this group on the rails, we need to make sure that we can look out and say that there are other parties out there and other potential scenarios, but it's not really necessarily worthwhile to chase that chain wherever it goes.
Fair point. Just before I go to you, Mikey, one other thing. I think Paul mentioned legally. I don't think legally would be a word I would be comfortable using, because legally somebody may have a right, but I think the question here, in my view anyway, is with regard to the ICANN contracts, what we as registrars have to do, not whether we're legally obliged to do something. So that might be...
Fully agree with you, Michele. In fact, when I was saying it, I'm making a little quotation motion with my fingertips. The focus should be contractual bound, however you want to define that, not legal in any broader term.
Well, that's fine. I'd just be afraid if we say legal, that somebody might start trying to give people rights that they don't really have. Mikey, and then Olaf. Mikey, go ahead.
This is Mikey again. This isn't one that I want to expend all of my political capital on, but maybe here's a way to resolve this in a way that works for everybody. I agree with everything you guys are saying. I think that one way to think of these is more in context settings. So, James, it might just be useful to highlight the list of people who don't have a role in the IRTP, especially the urgent return process, when it comes down to that, and then include these definitions in that list, to make it clear to the registrant. You know, this is, I think, mostly for registrants. Clearly, the registrars are sophisticated about it.
So basically, what you're saying is that in some ways, by defining who isn't involved, it helps to define who is involved.
Yeah, and that's the only purpose that I would think it might be useful to leave the definition. You know, remember, this is just a list of definitions. This isn't saying anything about policy. But I think it's useful for our registrars or registrants to know, oh, the service provider has nothing to do with the transfer. When it comes down to brass tacks, it's the registrant, you know, it's the list above that has it, that touches that. And I think it's more for sort of an educational clarification purpose that I'm interested in calling those out, than in any way saying that they should be bound or included in any policy that we write.
I think that's a fair enough point. Who's next there? Olaf was next, then James.
Chris in the queue, please.
I'm very much connect to what Mike said, I think, and what Paul said. I mean, when we come to any policy language, I think we're way beyond limits with all these definitions, which are partly, I mean, there are roles that are overlapping and all of that. But I think when it comes to trying to describe any scenarios we would like to describe, well, it can be useful, but one perhaps could rather keep the definitions on the side burner while we start discussing the gist of the matter and see which ones that may evolve and which we may find useful in our descriptions. But I believe that the definitions for any policy statements or such would be have to be pretty much restrained to clearer roles. Thanks.
Okay. Olaf, could you take your hand down, please?
Oh, yeah. I always forget.
Because it confuses me, like, and it just causes headaches. Anybody else want to jump in there with any thoughts or comments on that?
Can I just jump in? I can't get on Connect. I'm out of the office.
That's okay.
Chris speaking, sorry. Yes, I think I tend to agree with Olaf and with Mike. You know, let's just park it there, and we'll see where we go with the report. And if we never mention service provider in the report, then there's no need for a definition for it. They're certainly there in the hijacking scenario, but possibly not in the transfer scenario, contractually anyway. But I did get the term from the ASAC report. It wasn't one that I just made up, so I think
well, just by way of explanation, I think part of the reason why myself, James, and Paul are so wary of introducing these terms is because several of us were involved in some other working groups where, how can I put this diplomatically, the terms of reference are being constantly expanded by certain parties and giving us massive headaches, so we're trying to make sure that the terms of reference of this working group remain within its parameters as much as possible. So
okay.
That's just to explain why we might seem to be overly paranoid. Anybody else on that one?
This is Mikey. I also like the term overly paranoid.
Do you want to add that to the list?
Yeah, I'd love that.
Okay, work away. And you can just say that Michele referred to registrars as being overly paranoid, and I'll have to live with that for years. I won't be able to go to an ICANN meeting. I'll have to hide. Okay.
Kelly, this is James.
Yes.
Just because I get the sense that we're about ready to move on from this list, I wanted to point out one area of distinction, and I think this goes to Mikey's point about making sure that we're all synchronized and on the same page. I just wanted to make sure that everyone is comfortable with the item 3, 4, and 5 on that list, the change of registrant, the change of account, and the transfer. And understanding, because in the industry, and I'm sure everyone sees it as well, all three of those operations are referred to loosely and in some cases incorrectly as transfers, when in fact only number 5 qualifies as a transfer under this policy and this working group. So I just wanted to get that out on the table because I think it is an area of confusion that we encounter probably daily in our work with registrants, and it's just something that I think that, in general, a bit of outreach to the community and education is probably a good thing.
Well, I like the thing on the education anyway. Mikey, then Paul.
Just to take this one step further in terms of narrowing our scope, we only worry about inter-registrar transfers in this group. Do you want to amp that up at all, James, in that definition of 5?
possibly, Mike, we could say that number five is an inter-registrar transfer, and that any three and four, in fact, do not leave the registrar. I do want to point out, however, that one of our charter questions, and I don't have the charter in front of me, does mention transfers as they relate to change of registrars. So I think it's, these other definitions will appear in our discussions, and they do appear in our charter. So I just wanted to make sure we've got them on the table.
I like them. I think they're great. This is Mikey.
Sorry, just one second. I'm jumping between multiple windows here. I think Paul was up next, was he?
Yes, thank you, Michaela. Just very quickly, I agree with James, and as others have already said on the list, for the non-ICANN literate folks out there, I think it's very important that we keep these other definitions James is suggesting so that folks that are not necessarily in the know will clearly understand that when we talk about IRTP, inter-registrar transfer policy, that's what the transfer is about. These other things that loosely get called transfers, don't get misled. And for our final, the report of this group, it probably is very helpful to have some of this language even up front and then quickly say, but that's not what this group's about, and get to number five. You know, focus on what we're really supposed to be here for.
Yeah, I agree with us. Anil George?
McKinley, I was just wondering, just looking at the things that you're trying to define, you have some fairly sort of fundamental definitions here. I'm curious, and I apologize if you've discussed this already, but do you also need to define registrar and registry, since if we're defining registrant, you know, they all exist together and they can't exist without each other?
It's a valid question, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a good one. This is Mikey. I buy that.
I don't have any issue with somebody defining them personally. I don't know. James? Paul?
As sure as Paul, I think we should do that. That's a good point, Anil. You know, for clarity's sake, let's get clear definitions out there right up front.
And as Anil, as you brought it up, do you want to provide them?
Yeah, I can take a shot at it.
Sorry, so if anybody brings up the question, I'll always volunteer them.
Let no good deed go unpunished.
Exactly. I mean, the other thing as well, I think was Paul who brought it up. I mean, this thing about people not understanding, I think that's a very, very important point. Most people don't understand.
No, this is Mikey. I really emphatically agree with that, and I think that's really where I was coming from in the other part of the discussion, is that maybe in addition to the policy portion of our report, if we could do some educating along the way, we might be able to help people a lot.
Chris here. In the ASAC report, actually Appendix A of the 2005 report, they have actually an overview of the register transfer process, which I found very useful. I mean, it needs updating. It might be something we could consider putting in an appendix as well.
That's great. And we had some, didn't we have that in the last IRTP report, Gang?
I remember this is James. I do remember a diagram and an overview, so maybe we can go back to IRTPA and borrow from that.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. We did a number of diagrams to try to depict the various scenarios as well relating to use of EPP and things like that. So I'm happy to as well recirculate these to the group here so we can see what additional work might be required or not.
Olaf?
Oh, yes, briefly. I sent around definitions we have in the ICANN glossary just as some kind of starting point for registrar and registry. I'll do that to the list.
Okay, cool. Anybody, anything else on that? So we're all agreed on the idea of let's make things nice and clear and simple so everybody knows what we're talking about. Yes? Okay, I'll take the silence to mean that you all agree with me. Okay, next on our agenda, RTP Part B public comment period update.
Yeah, this is Marika. I sent I circulated to the group earlier today the announcement on the opening of this public comment forum. And just to note as well that it has been translated in the five UN languages, and we'll be accepting comments as well in those languages. I think this is quite a bit of an experiment that will hopefully inform as well some of the ongoing discussions on how to reform the policy development process and what role translation should have in that. So this is for now a one-off exercise to see how that works and how much extra delay this results in, because of course comments will need to be translated back to English for the group to review these. So we'd just like to encourage everyone to have a look at that and forward it to any group or individual you think might be interested in providing comments.
Thanks, Marika, and thanks for indulging my madness by insisting on having it in more than one language. Sorry, guys, I'm a languages graduate. This was kind of inevitable. Anybody have anything else to say about the public comment period? No?
No, other than just to thank Marika and say I think it's great that we're doing an experiment on this and leading the way.
See, we'll go down in history. If it's a success, they'll thank us. If it's a failure, they'll blame me. I would ask people, though, to please, if you could, try and encourage people to comment. I mean, pass it around to your colleagues, to your friends, to your next-door neighbor. Paul?
Yeah, exactly to that point, Michele. Just a question, Marika. What is the time frame? These public comments, is this open for the duration of the working group? Is there a particular deadline? I'm sorry, I haven't looked at the announcement, if it's there.
If I remember correctly, the deadline is the 5th of October. It's a 20-day deadline that's imposed by the ICANN bylaws.
Is there a possibility of extending that, Marika, if we deem it necessary?
I don't think there's any objection. I don't know. I mean,
I'm just asking. I'm just looking more just to have a complete view rather than anything else.
This is all of it has been done before.
And I think an alternative is as well, I've received, for example, a request on another public comment period that has just closed where I've basically indicated to the person that wanted to submit a comment, you know, just send it to me directly and I'll make sure that it gets forwarded to the group. Because the only challenge is, of course, at a certain point we need to summarize the comments and put forward an analysis. If we keep on getting in comments, it's difficult to do that process. So either we, you know, need extend it for a certain time, or we just say, you know, any comments that people want to make, they can still make either by just sending it to me or to you, Michaela, and we'll, you know, put them all forward to the group.
Yep, fair enough. No, as I say, it was just more a case of being, you know, clear about what we're doing. Clear for me, at least, anyway, and everybody else, hopefully. And thank you, Mikey. Sorry, Mikey's comments on Adobe are making me laugh. What was the next item on the agenda? Okay, constituency statement template. Okay, has anybody got anything to say about that?
This is Marika. Following the last call, I think some people indicated that they would be interested to think about some additional questions that they would like to put in this template for constituencies to consider and hopefully respond to. I did repost the template to the list, but there hasn't been any discussion or suggestion. So the question would be, do people need more time to come up with these questions? You know, and if not, can we just then get it out to the constituencies and give them ample time to provide feedback?
So, any thoughts on that, James?
Yes, Kelly. Thanks, Marika. I did review the latest version, and I was fine with that. I think that there was some concern regarding whether it was too jargon-heavy, and I think that you've addressed that as well. Question would be, what is ample time? Is there a standard window for turnaround on these constituency statements? Because we have quite a few in the pipeline right now, and I just want to make sure that they're all getting their due attention.
I think the bylaws do prescribe something, but I think overall we've given constituencies more time. I think the official deadline is 20 days, but I know for example, the post-expiration one, we've asked the different constituency representatives on the call what will be reasonable. And I think in that case, they indicated that 30 days would be good. So I guess the question would be again for those of you on the call that are part of constituencies and will be working on this, what time frame would be reasonable to come back to this group? Because I think the important thing is that this group gets the right information, sufficient detail, and if that's helped by a few extra days, I don't think we should restrict that.
Well, I'd like to be the first in line to lobby for a little bit of an extended time frame once this is published or released to the constituencies.
And what would that time frame be?
The 30 days sounds good.
This is Mikey. How far away from Seoul are we? I've lost track of the calendar.
About maybe 5 weeks?
I think it's about 30 days before people start traveling, basically. A little bit more than that. Now the 15th of September, and I think GNSO meetings are starting 24th of October.
So I guess the question is, in my mind, are we going to try and get these done before people go to Seoul, or should we let it slip over the meeting? Because if it tangles with the meeting, then all of a sudden we're way out. We'd have to add a couple more weeks, it would seem to me.
Well, I guess the question is, if no one wants to add anything, we can get it out today or tomorrow, and that should give people 30 days before they leave Seoul. But I guess the question would be, are there many other things that people are doing now that they need to get done by Seoul that would conflict with with this work?
Insert hysterical laughter into the record for me, thanks. I think it's fine. If we got it out today or tomorrow and gave it 30 days, I think we can turn that around here.
I think I'd agree as well. I mean, if we leave it for much longer, it's going to start coming into time just before Seoul and into Seoul, and people aren't going to reply. Anybody else have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we've got to fight our, Chris here, we've got to fight our own corner, as it were, and go for 30 days and not put it back because of Seoul.
Yeah, this is Mikey. I'm fine with that.
Okay. Moving on. Sorry, I'm being a total tyrant here today. Of course, I keep losing the agenda, which doesn't help. Right, what was the next thing there? IoTP. Okay. Now, the next item on the agenda was continued discussion on issue A, whether a process for urgent return / resolution of a domain name should be developed as discussed within the SAC hijacking report. Thoughts? Mikey, hand up. Go ahead.
This one collides with so many other TDPs that are going on right now. Maybe we need to do our scope narrowing thing again on this. What do others think? Because, we've got the post-domain expiry one that's going, and I guess that's the other one that's really... Do we need to narrow this to only talk about urgent return of domains that have been transferred inter-registrar?
Mr. Collins.
I was just going to answer, Mike. I think I had assumed that was the transfer return that we meant was an inter-registrar transfer reversal.
I think we might want to just add that into the statement, because if we don't, we run the risk of colliding with a much broader issue than perhaps we want to take on.
James?
So if I'm understanding Mikey's question correctly, leveraging our definition list, we're only talking about the urgent return as per item number 5, which is an inter-registrar transfer. Is that what you're asking, Mikey? Mikey?
Sorry. You know, I was so eloquent on mute. I always say my very best stuff on mute. Sorry. I think it's the definition in the note on Adobe, and if that's just sort of an informal one and our actual charge has the inter-registrar narrowing in it, I'm fine. I just this one reads much broader. And I'm not sure that we want to tackle the whole gamut of urgent return resolution issues, especially given that the post-domain expiry PDP is also running in parallel with this.
Understood, and if I could just follow up on that. Most registrars, we do, and I'm sure most registrars would also, if they're offering the other two types of functions, the change of account or the change of registrant, would probably have their own internal undo procedures as well. I feel like those kind of go hand in hand, but it's not necessarily something we can discuss here on this group, but they do exist.
This is Mikey, and just to intrude one last time, maybe this is another education opportunity where as we proceed down the narrow tracks that I think we're all agreed to, we make it clear what the things we're not covering are at the same time.
Okay, Barbara and then Marika, or Marika then Barbara.
This is Barbara. From my perspective, I don't think that the current transfer policy and the dispute policy that that goes with that really contemplates the urgent return of a domain name. And so, I mean, in fact, one of the first things that the transfer dispute policy indicates is that registrars are encouraged to try to resolve the dispute themselves. And I would almost think that urgent return should be addressed at that level because, as I said, the dispute policy doesn't really contemplate a quick return of a domain name, and I think, you know, time is of the essence. I think that there is value in, you know, perhaps addressing this somewhere, maybe through a best practices document that registrars could put in place, and there may be a role as well that the registries could play, but I'm not certain that it would be best addressed in this particular PDP.
Marika?
Yeah, it isn't regard. I just wanted to point out, I can see if you see the question by itself without the context that, you know, you might go in all kinds of directions, but as this is part of an IRTP PDP, and I think that's pointed out as well in, you know, the charter itself, you know, it shouldn't lead to too much confusion as to what this is relating to. I do agree, I think in the issues or in the initial report, we can definitely provide some further explanation as what this means, but if we would change the charter questions, this would be something that would need to be taken back to the council.
James?
Hi, thanks. This is James. I wanted to go back one speaker to Barbara and just kind of touch on what she mentioned. And I think she's, in many ways, she's absolutely correct, is that registrars can and do work out a lot of these issues on their own or within with one another. And that, I think, is works pretty well when you're talking about, you know, for example, GoDaddy working with Paul's organization, Network Solutions, or McKelly, or some of the folks that are visible and participating and easy to reach, contact, et cetera. But I think, Barbara, my take on this particular question was whether or not there needs to be some sort of an escalation process when that breaks down and when we're dealing on the edges here of a registrar that is either not responsive or has gone dark or is possibly even complicit in those types of activities. So I think the way I read it was that we were looking for an emergency channel that we could work through when the registrar to registrar process fails.
May I just go ahead and jump in? Since
no, work away.
This is Barbara. I mean, I think you're reading my mind exactly, James, because I don't agree, and that's I don't disagree. One of the things, you know, when I was saying there could very well be a role for registries as well in that process, and I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, to the extent that you're working or trying to work with a registrar who is not responsive, then there may be an area for registries to step in at that point. So I agree with what you're saying there. I'm just not certain that...
Follow up with that, I think I 100% support the idea that the dispute process is, I'm going to struggle to put this diplomatically, is not really viewed as a reliable mechanism to undo a transfer, either from perspective of timeliness or in perspective of how what sort of consistency of output we can expect from that process. So if we in this group develop an urgent return process that's an escalation that involves registries and registrars whenever the existing methods fail, then you know, I think that we need to think about whether or not we're invalidating that other dispute method, and if so, you know, I don't think you're going to get any objections over here because we don't really have a lot of faith in it.
Marika?
yeah, I didn't take my hand down.
No, you didn't.
Can I put my hand up, Chris, here?
Oh, work away. Well,
maybe the urgency element of it, we're talking about when the DNS has changed, because in a hijack or transfer that's sort of alleged to hijack, if the DNS hasn't changed, it's still just sort of an administrative function, no?
This is Mikey. I just want to chime in and support James and Barbara's kind of refinement of this. Because I think it, having been involved in a few of these in the real world, you know, when you're dealing with James's organization and Paul's organization and Barbara's organization, it's generally not an issue. It's when you're on the edges. And so I like the introduction of the idea of escalation or something like that to let the sort of default norm be Barbara's position, which is let the experienced capable players work it out amongst themselves, and when that fails, have an avenue for escalating. So I just wanted to chime in support of all that.
Okay. I also like the idea that if you're dealing with somebody you can't reach, that there is some way of escalating it, taking them out of the picture, which I think pretty much echoes what James and Paul and other people were saying. Anything else on that?
This is James. I'm sorry, Michael Collins had a note on the list relative to whether who can initiate a transfer dispute. Did we want to...
This is Brigitte. It's a question for all of. Isn't that one of the issues that comes up as well in the later... One of the issues in the later PDPs?
It rings a bell, yes, but don't take me off the cuff. I mean, we should look into the other ones. I don't know them by heart, as I should say.
It does ring a bell for me as well that it has come up somewhere, so I can double-check that.
This is Mikey. I think it's worth taking an initial crack at it in this discussion, because we may learn some things we have that conversation that we can apply down the road.
Okay.
Michele, it's Paul. Can I jump in?
Oh, work away.
Yeah, just to respond, the Envision PDPD has a question about the transfer dispute resolution policy. but the focus of that was how do you handle disputes when multiple transfers have occurred? I guess it'll depend on the scoping at the time when it's created. Are we really focused on the policy itself and the limitations that some of us feel that exist today?
An additional question in that same category is whether dispute options for registrants should be developed and implemented as part of the policy. So that would address the question that Michael Collins has posted. Of course, if this group starts discussing this question and realizes that, you know, the broader debate should be had, an option would be to go back to the council and ask whether this question can be incorporated or possibly defer discussions until this PDP occurs. There are two options that might be considered if the group feels strongly that that discussion should be had as a whole.
Sorry, Marika, just to get this clear in my head, so there are several other PDPs related to this already planned. Is that what people are saying?
But we're currently in IRTP Part B, and there are issues outlined under PDP C, D, and E. What I just read off is what is listed under PDP D, which has categorized some issues related to IRTP dispute policy enhancements.
And is there a list of these upcoming PDPs anywhere?
Yes, I can circulate that document. This was developed, I think, in March 2008, and we basically started with A. Then now we're in B, but B, for example, has already incorporated some issues from PDPC that people felt at the time that were closely related, and it made sense to put them together into one PDP. So I will circulate that document to the group so everyone can see what other issues are going to be considered in the context of the review of the IRTP.
Okay, thank you.
Chris here. Issues report, page 10, has a quick chart you can quickly look at.
Yeah, I think the quick chart just has the headers, and under each of those headers you have 3-4 issues listed with some explanation.
Okay, so maybe, Marika, if you could circulate that to the list, it would be helpful anyway, so we have some idea of what we're talking about.
This is Mikey. I want to get us back to the who initiates thing. It may be that the who initiates on this escalation is different than the who initiates on some of the other stuff. So I think it might be worth... You know, I can envision who initiates on this one being registry, registrar, or registrant, whereas in some of the others that may not be the case. So I just want to throw that monkey wrench into the process, because this is the urgent escalation situation, which may be different than the less urgent stuff that's contemplated in some of those other things.
So, in your view, who do you think would be initiating it?
I'm not really sure until we sort of see how this unfolds. In general, in the prior PDPs on IRTP, we've shied away from registrants initiating. In most cases, we've felt more comfortable with registrars or registries. But on this one, I could envision a situation where something's gone catastrophically wrong, the process is broken down so badly that we might want to open the door up to registrants, but I don't want to throw my body on the tracks on that one just yet.
James? Sorry, Marika.
I just wanted to point out that, you know, in relation to the question that Mikey raises, I mean, some of the questions that we pointed out as well in the issues report that would need to be considered in this context, like, what is the actual extent of this problem? you know, would it warrant a new procedure or you know, changes to the policy? How do you ensure a fair process? And I think that relates back to the question as well, like, who would be the decision maker? Who decides whether it's actually a hijacking or not? And, you know, who's indeed the initiator? And maybe review as well which market solutions or best practice already exist that, you know, either a registrant or a registry or registrar can make use of to address this issue.
Are you all following the notes that Barbara Steele put up there on the on Adobe?
This is Mikey. I like that a lot, Barbara.
Barbara, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I was just going to go ahead and mention, I mean, just at the end of the day, I mean, the registrars actually own the relationship with the registrants. There's actually no, I guess, benefit of contract directly between the registry and the registrant. However, you know, the registries are charged with making certain that registrars are complying with the policy. And if we find that there is a registrar that is not submitting a what a registrant considers to be a valid transfer dispute or violation of the policy, then obviously that's something we would need to take up with the registrars.
What would you, how would that be handled normally, Barbara, at the moment?
To the extent that we would get a complaint here at VeriSign, as I said, we would reach out to the registrar that was responsible, I guess, for the domain name and the original relationship with the registrant to basically speak with them about the fact that they would need to submit a transfer dispute on behalf of the registrant. So more than likely, if it's a case where a domain name was transferred fraudulently or in violation of the policy, then we would go to, in essence, the losing registrar. If it's a case where a domain name is being nacked by the registrar of record, then we would go to them and explain to them that, you know, they do need to be processing the transfer disputes in accordance with, or transfer requests in accordance with the transfer policy.
And just following up on that, just me being really curious, do you have any kind of statistics on the number of times that you would have to actually intercede on behalf of registrants?
Since the new policy has gone into effect, I would say, and that was 2004, November of 2004, I would say probably twice.
So basically it doesn't really happen?
It doesn't happen that often.
Michael, then James.
Barbara, pardon my ignorance, but is there actually a requirement in the policy for registrars to file a transfer dispute, or is it just a policy that enables registrars to file a dispute?
I guess I should defer to an attorney on that one.
I apologize. Well, my other question is, I have heard of at least one case recently, and I don't have any it's not firsthand, but it was just something I read about where a registrar refused to file a transfer dispute because the registrant couldn't prove that they were the registrant on the day of the transfer. So, I mean, it could be difficult for a registrant, I suppose, without a cooperative registrar.
Definitely, and I mean, I'm sure it depends on what the registrar was also asking for as proof of identity. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, if it's a case of a transfer in violation of the policy where it did go from one registrar to another and they're looking for it to be returned to the original registrar, the losing registrar, the former registrar of record, should have the WHOIS data, and then it's up to the registrar to determine what form of identification to confirm the person's identity at the time that the transfer was initiated. You know, they also are supposed to have, you know, and retain copies of the forms of authorization or FOAs. So I guess I question whether or not, you know, the registrar was really, I don't know how I should say it, you know, truly looking at the request from the registrant, because technically they should have all of the information available to them to determine who the registrant was at the time that, that the transfer occurred.
I will say that the registrant completely agrees with you.
James, Mikey? James, I think you should go in this time.
Yeah, sorry. I just was trying to jump in there and answer or address one of the questions that Barbara had raised, which was the frequency of disputes and how often those are that policy is used. I can tell you that the answer is not often. For example, we, in first quarter of this year, I think, initiated 16 transfer disputes. That's relative to about 700 instances where we worked either internally or with another registrar to undo a transfer. So just to give you an idea of the proportions of what we're talking about with the formal policy versus how often we're working with the other registrars.
This is Mikey. Actually, I was going to jump in on this same topic. I think it would be, I mean, these are really helpful sort of tiers. It seems like there's a bigger number, not a huge number, but a bigger number of disputes that are worked out registrar to registrar, and then a smaller number that get filed and an even smaller number that actually get seen at Barbara's end. So we've got sort of anecdotal numbers of 715 and 2. And part of what I'm wondering is two things. Is there a way to firm those numbers up without generating a boatload of work for a lot of people, or do we even need to? And then the second is back to the education thing, and I wonder if the reason that it's so few is because in many cases registrars just don't know what to do. I don't really have good...
Sorry, you're saying that the number of cases, the small number of cases is due to registrar ignorance, is that it?
No, I'm sorry. Registrant ignorance, I meant to say.
Okay, sorry. Just we're clear.
Those words are so close together for an old man.
I know. My staff get confused as well, and they're meant to know. Paul, get me started about these things, please.
Not at all. Just trying to weigh in here and answer a couple things that have been raised. For Mikey and Barbara and everybody throwing out facts and figures, I don't know. Honestly, I think it will be very, very difficult to get more comprehensive numbers. What James has just shared, let's leave it at the anecdotal level, but I think most registrars would consider a lot of that stuff proprietary information. But directionally, I think all registrars would agree that what we're discussing right now is directionally accurate, that there's a very large number of disputes, and then as you start winnowing through the various processes that are available, you wind up with a very, very small number on the end. Part of which also, if you go back and read the TDRP, one of the challenges we have is that when it gets escalated up to the registry level, when they look if the inappropriate transfer was initiated because the bad guy, let's call the person who took the name, had changed the contact information and then initiated the transfer request, when the registry looks at it, they see it as, it appears to them as legitimate. So it gets thrown back to the registrars to try and figure out what went on before the request was initiated. Look, these are all very complicated things, but this overall, this dispute policy, it's good that we're having a discussion because some of it could get to this question of, the urgent response. Do we necessarily need new regulations, new rules, or can we go back to an existing tool that we have and perhaps tighten it, refine it, and end up with the kind of new tool that we're hoping for, some way to deal with it. And the question of if you have an unresponsive registrar and only, at this point, only registrars can initiate, do we need to open it up so that the registrant can have some way of raising their voice, saying, look, I was wronged here, get me back my name, and then there's a clear path for them to take to get the name returned.
This is Mikey. Just thumbs up on that. That's exactly where I'd like us to go.
Okay. Barbara, you're from the registry constituency.
Correct.
Is there anybody else from the registry constituency in on this call?
I think Eric Brown is the only other person, and I don't anticipate that he's on the call today.
Okay, that's fine. Does the registry constituency have anything further on this that they could share with the rest of us in terms of the volumes of these kind of complaints that they're getting?
I did put some clarifications down in the chat area.
Right.
To clarify, the two that I was referring to are those instances where a registrant has come to us, and I agree that the overall number of actual transfer disputes that are seen at the registrar level is significantly higher than what we see here at the registry, and I think everybody recognizes that the process under the TDRP is very long. If you play out at all the different time frames between the time that a registrar files a transfer dispute, the other registrar responds, there's a review period, it can go on, it can be appealed. I mean, you literally could spend over 100 days trying to get resolution on an issue if it goes the full spectrum of what's contemplated by the TDRP. So, the number that we actually see at the registry level is significantly lower. It's just a fraction probably a percent of what is actually seen between registrars in resolving transfer disputes.
Okay, thank you. Barbara, just from my curiosity, in terms of volume of these disputes that you're seeing being initiated by the registrars, I mean, are you talking about one or two a week or hundreds a week or what kind of volume?
We may see one or two a month.
Okay.
Quite honestly, we see more court orders than we do transfer disputes.
Okay. And the court orders would be in relation to what, to the same topic?
It could be relating to the right to use a domain name, or in some cases it could be an inappropriate transfer where people opt to go to court versus using the transfer dispute policy or even doing a UDRP.
Right. Marika?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, and it's actually in the issues report and actually a comment made by GoDaddy, so James might have more to add, because one of the reasons I think that they suggested that a procedure might be considered is that apparently some registrants who consider that their domain name hijacked go to towards a UDRP process. And I presume that, in that case, a registrar has to lock down the domain and has all kinds of other implications. So that was seen as a reason why this might be pursued. And James, I would invite you to provide further comments if I mischaracterized your the submission from GoDaddy in that respect. But it might be something worth to consider as well for this group.
I think I would have to confer with some of the folks internally in domain services and figure out what the impetus was for that.
Kevin?
Now, I'd like to go back to the one comment about it may also be useful to comment about things that we should exclude, because it does seem like to the extent that there's a problem that the registrant would have because of some ownership dispute, that the emergency provisions, while that may be what they want to have, would not be appropriate to be handled under the ICANN policy. And if there's a legitimate legal dispute, then it seems to me that ICANN isn't the appropriate place to have that dispute resolved. I think, ICANN implementing a court order is the way to go, and that we should be very clear that we are talking about procedures between the contracting parties rather than sort of conflicts external to those procedures.
Mariko? Is your hand still up by accident?
Taking it down, sorry.
Okay, that's all right, it's okay. I'm trying to make sure I don't miss people because then people start complaining at me.
This is Mikey. I'd like to chime in right behind Kevin. I think Kevin's got the start of a pretty productive idea there that we might want to clarify what would be an inappropriate use of such a policy as well as what's an appropriate one. So I just wanted to give that one a thumbs up.
Okay. Somebody's putting in something very, very big into the Adobe. Oh, God, what is this?
Yeah, that's me. I just copied the language from the issues report, what I was just referring to.
Okay. In response to the ICANN request for public comments on the experiences with the inter-registrar transfer, the GoDaddy Group notes that if a registered name holder feels that a third party has illegally hijacked his or her domain name through a transfer, they may lodge a UDRP dispute. This complicates the issue since the registrars involved may be willing to work to correct the situation, but now have their hands tied, etc., etc., etc. Of course, once you initiate the UDRP process, then you can't really resolve it otherwise, can you?
This is Mikey. That sounds a lot like Tim.
He's not here to defend his good name, so
yeah, I'm not doing this in a pejorative way at all. It's just that I remember Tim saying something almost exactly like that in one of the earlier PDPs. And so, James, when you run back, you might just check with Tim. I'll bet you'll find the source there.
Barbara.
I guess the question I would have is, and I don't know if anybody on the call knows, is whether or not you could actually withdraw a UDRP case after it's been submitted.
You can suspend it.
Okay.
You can suspend it or you can cancel it completely. I know this for dealing with UDRPs for CCTLDs. I presume that the UDRP process is the same for GTLD. Because we've had clients who've been doing it both sides, and they've managed to reach arrangements outside of the WIPO process, which is basically and stalled it or cancelled it and everything else. But I'm not too sure how long it takes to actually do that, as it were. I don't know if anybody has anything else to add on. James, have you had much to do with them? With UDRPs?
With UDRPs, no.
This is Mikey. I think
that's suspending UDRP as well.
Sorry?
This is Mikey. I think what Tim was talking about is that sometimes the UDRP is used as sort of a spanner in the works to jam a process to stop, to give people time to work something out. Again, I'm sort of putting words in his mouth. But
this is Paul.
Go ahead.
If I can, just to respond, Mikey, I think you're misreading the comment there. Rather, the UDRP is very, very explicit about what registrars must do once we receive notification that an action has been commenced. And the way I read it, because it's our own experience, it can be a source of frustration that because registrants may not be aware of other alternative means, the tool that they know is UDRP, they initiate the process, we get notification, we're required to lock down the name. If the name came into us, if it's gone elsewhere, the other registrar must. That's the source of frustration, because once that's in place, until such time as either the panel makes its determination or the parties to the case terminate the UDRP, we just have to basically go into a holding pattern. You know, when there could be other channels, whether you work it out mutually between the registrars, use a dispute policy, any other tool, what we're discussing is a possible new tool as well. All of those things are taken off the table. They're not available anymore because the UDRP process, which is a contractual obligation of registrars, by the way, requires us to lock things down.
Now, this is Mikey. Actually, I agree 100% with that. I think we're just saying the same thing with a different perspective. But I agree that using the UDRP in this circumstance is probably a really bad idea. It's just that it's the only thing that not so well educated registrants know to use, so they sort of pull the pin on that grenade in many cases inappropriately.
I mean, just speaking from my own personal experience, I mean, we were able to rectify a situation involving a domain, thanks in part to James's help, without having to go into anything kind of crazy. Just emailing the right people, stuff was sorted out without there being massive UDRPs and court cases and God knows what else. I think James knows what I'm talking about.
Well, Paul and I just had an experience like that, too. This is Mikey again. I agree. I think what we're working on here is a pretty narrow case. Again, back to the what's included and what's excluded list. That doesn't happen very often, and we hope continues not to happen very often. But it's sort of a more productive, useful, accurate approach to resolving those few issues rather than the sort of the use of inappropriate tools like UDRP.
Yeah, this is Paul, but just to follow on, Mikey, I think one of the reasons why we need to address this as a working group now, we have new GTLDs on the horizon, which could represent, scores, hundreds of new extensions, many, many more registration players, registrars, resellers, etc. And if we don't have these rules sort of clearly thought through and well publicized, and I underscore the well-publicized part, it may be very difficult in the not so distant future to find enough willing and capable white hat parties to work these things out. Better to have the processes clearly laid out there for everybody to use and to act upon. Also, when there are policy, you can also get back to those registrars that may not be compliant, that in some cases may even be complicit in facilitating illicit transfers and whatnot, that you can bring compliance actions against them.
Yeah, absolutely. Mikey here. I agree 100%.
Silence.
Golden.
Disturbing, actually.
It's that hum of consensus.
I hold on a second there. Come on. Somebody has to throw a spanner in the works.
Clock is counting down.
Okay. Anything else on that, guys and girls? Just so you're aware, in Irish terms, guys is not gender specific, in case anybody starts getting offended. Okay, we'll move on then. What was the next item on the agenda? Million windows open here again. Okay, the next meeting, I think, was the next item on the agenda. We're still working on the every 2 weeks thing, are we?
Yes, I think that's so.
Okay,
I think, though, that there's a conflict 2 weeks from now with a call about
creating
malicious conduct that's popped up. That's scheduled at the same time as our normal 2 weeks from now call would be.
No, I think it's scheduled. We would have to finish after an hour because I think that one only starts at 1500 UTC, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's correct.
So
the next call would need to be 60 minutes rather than 90.
Ah, okay.
Which was this malicious conduct thing, since I seem to have missed
it? A webinar on new GTLDs and mitigating malicious conduct at that time.
Okay, I'm just going to see if I can find it. Sorry, my inbox is, as usual, a mess.
I'm not sure that you got it. It's been publicized sort of unevenly. It went out to the council and didn't make it through the BC list.
Oh, I got it on the at-large list, I think. The one on the September 29th at 1500 UTC?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, I got that. Right, that went into a different folder. Somebody registered the domain mitigate.ie as well. There you go. Sorry. Useless trivia for you. Okay, so do we want to... We just want to keep running the normal 60 minutes instead of 90 then in that case. Or do people want to reschedule it, or what do people want to do?
60 minutes is fine with me. This is Mikey.
Michael, I can do 60 as well.
Okay. Anybody have anything else to say about timing? No?
Mr. Morgan, I do have a question. For the next meeting, do you then just want to move on to issue B? First have a discussion on all the issues before going back to A and, you know, consider potential solutions or recommendations?
Well, I would personally, from my perspective, okay, the public comment period is open. When do we need to do anything with the constituency template at this juncture, or can we send it out?
I thought the consensus was just to send it out and give constituencies 30 days to provide their feedback.
Anybody have any objections to us sending out the constituency template? Okay, we'll take the silence to mean that there aren't any problems with that. So, yeah, I mean, just plow on, I suppose. Is there anything anybody particularly wants to see on the agenda for the next meeting? No? Okay. So can we draw this to a close then?
No, let's drag it all the way out.
Yeah, well, that's the thing I'm afraid of, you know. But there's probably some masochist somewhere on this phone call who actually enjoys dragging these things out.
I was on mute. What was that?
Okay, never mind. Okay, for those of you in American time zones, maybe you need to drink more coffee. For those of us in European time zones, we definitely need more coffee. For totally different reasons. Speak to some of you this evening and speak to the rest of you in 2 weeks then.
Alrighty.
Bye.
Great. Thank Very you. Good. Thanks, Michele.
Thanks, Michele.
Alright, thanks, Marika and Co.
Good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.